afternoon. Today is March 20th, 2018, and we're at the home of Leslie Corvola. I'm Terry Spires, and I'm here with Leslie. We thank her so much for coming today and sharing your story. Hopefully, your story will be part of the Raven Landing Resident Stories Project. We'll start with a little biographical information. Can you tell us where and when you were born?
I was born and raised in San Francisco, and I was born on April 1st, 1939. It has been a family joke all my life. I will tell you a little bit about my parents, because I think they have interesting backgrounds. Number one, my father came to America in 1923 as a 19-year-old. He came from Germany, and he lived to be 90 years old, so he had a long life as an American citizen. My mother was a native Californian, and she grew up in Kern County near Porterville, and she was raised by her grandmother because her mother died in childbirth out in the country. And her father went into town to register this baby, and registered as Leslie. Well, how do you spell Leslie? And that's how I ended up with the misspelling that's in the family, because everybody, and my mother did not know that her name was spelled wrong, so that when she, her dad died when she was quite young, and she had to go to court to prove who she was at 16, she didn't know that she was misspelling her name, but I have papers from her schoolwork where it, one year it's L-E-S-L-I-E, and then it changes to L-E-S-L-Y-E. So.
Interesting.
It's a little twist.
Yeah. And so you grew up in San Francisco?
I grew up in the Mission District in San Francisco, and in April, my daughter and I are going down to San Francisco to go through the house. My dad had the house for over 50 years, having bought it in 1925 for $7,500. And the people who live there now are quite interested because I have documents that could be of value to them in registering the city, the house, because it was built in 1906.
Are there any other stories about your parents that you would like to tell us, or any of your ancestors, anything of note that you'd like in the record?
Well, my mother's ancestors were the Hockets, and they came to Porterville and were instrumental in bringing the railroad so that the street next to Main Street is Hockett Street in Porterville, California. The Hocketts had a lot of money. My mother was the granddaughter of this family, but her mother died in childbirth, and so Mom was kind of the orphan all her life, and she did very well. But she married my dad. They had their birthday on the same day, 10 years apart. And my father was a wonderful father to my mother because she had never known a father. My mother was a heart of gold. She's the only person in the world that I've ever known who could give unconditional love to anybody and everybody. I didn't appreciate that as a child, of course. She loved everybody more than me, and I'm so grateful that today I have a daughter who is so much like my mother that I get to appreciate my daughter even as I never appreciated my mother. I had a fast mouth all my life, and that's why this interview is hard for me to keep short. I could go on and on and on with stories.
Can you tell us about what brought you to Alaska?
Well, you see, I told you it's going to be a long story. I was married after I got out of the university. I grew up during the war, and my father forbade us to speak German in the household because my mother didn't speak German. In this house, we speak only English. And I was a smart kid who said, "This is a German accent." The German accent later turned out to be a gift to me. But my mother cherished my father's background and always encouraged me to learn the language. I was married. Well, let me go backwards. I was engaged, married, and widowed in 1 year when I was 23. And I decided that I could go to Germany. I went to Germany for a year. But in between, I met people who were friends of my first husband, and they were from Anchorage, and they were interested in how I was teaching German at that time, the new audiolingual method. And the fact that these very smart, well-educated, master degree level teachers were interested in me in my first year of teaching, I decided I wanted to go to Alaska. I decided I would go to Alaska on December 30th, 1964. Four or three. No, 63, because in 64 they had the earthquake. And I already knew I was coming to Alaska because of this couple. And I remained close friends with Mary for many, many years. She was a math teacher, as was my first husband. I came to Alaska, but I was outspoken, as I've said. I came to teach German. And I started the German program here in at Lathrop, but I was looking for a husband. And in that department, the language department, as I wrote to my mother, oh, yeah, it wasn't looking very good. The only other single man was dull as dishwater. My life would have been dull as dishwater if I hadn't married him. And so it was that at the end of my first year of teaching, it was in cement that I would stay in Alaska and in Fairbanks.
And in Fairbanks. So when did you marry Dick?
I married Dick in May 22nd, 1965. No, I came in 65. I did wait at least 9 months. It was 1966 that we were married, and I should remember the year because we celebrated our 50th wedding anniversary, and that was always a dream that he would live so long that he was at the Pioneer Home for 6 years, holding out. When he went into the Pioneer Home, I really needed that help, and he said, "It's too soon. I will outlive my long-term care insurance." And he was right. He did. But anyhow, that's beyond my present answer.
Regarding your career, can you tell us what led you to this career? And tell us a little bit about your career, what the kinds of things you did during your teaching time.
My mother said I was born to be a teacher. And I think from the time I was about 8 years old, I knew I wanted to be a teacher. I really wanted to be a math teacher. I loved math, but math didn't love me. And about that time in university, I had a professor who pointed out I did not have an American accent in my German. Well, I went on then to become a German teacher. And this was a wonderful gift because all of my father's family in Germany they had come through the war, and after my first husband died, I spent the year living with them and really getting a grounding in my language. I love teaching German. And so when I married Dick, which is a part of my career, he said, "Oh, that'd be so wonderful to be able to spend a whole year." He was teaching French. Oh, I said, "We just have to plan for it." And before we had, so for 2 years, we saved all of my in, my income so that we would be able to live 1 year, two people. And in the meantime, we had gone out to St. Lawrence Island. And the pilot said, now this is long before there was a political person who said this line, but on clear days you can see into the Soviet Union from here. Oh, Dick said, that'd be so interesting. He had his master's degree, and he had written it on the Yalta Conference. And he really wanted to know about the Russian people, not just those who were in political positions. Oh, I said, we're on our way to France. Anyhow, it's just a matter of planning for it. I don't think it's quite that easy. Oh, yes, I said, we can do that. And I wrote and corresponded with an interest affiliate in San Francisco, made all the plans, and in 1968, we went to France via the Soviet Union, spending 2 months there. And it was the beginning of a whole lifetime of a career that involved Russia and the Soviet Union, but in reverse, the Soviet Union and then Russia. I love teaching, but after 2 years of teaching here in Fairbanks, I took leave to travel. And when I came back, I only taught one more year teaching German. And I was at Ryan the year that it opened. And then I took another leave because I wanted to be home and raise my own children. Well, Katie came along, and there was no question in my mind, but I never was very far from the classroom and did a lot of volunteer teaching over the years and became very involved with the Pipeline Impact Information Center Advisory Committee. I was their token housewife. But I was always prompted to understand not just the human impacts, but the economic impacts. My husband by that time was teaching economics, and he said, you need to go back to school and get a degree in economics, at least study economics. So I went back to university. I went to University of Alaska Fairbanks, and I have a master's degree in resource economics, which then qualified me for the position of being the manager of the Community Research Center, which was the follow-up to the Pipeline Impact Office. So I always was their hysterical historical advisor. And then I was no longer on their board, but I actually became the manager of the Community Research Center. And I loved that dream because I was really teaching, doing a lot of teaching on economic situations, and did some adjunct professor. I was an adjunct professor up at the university, helping people with basic business concepts and planning and doing resumes and this sort of thing. And to me, it is just such an amazing thing. God had a plan, and I didn't ever know where I was going, but I followed it. And in 1992, and at that time, of course, the Soviet Union had broken up, and Fairbanks had become sister city to Yakutsk. And, well, it was always convenient for them to stay at our house because Dick spoke Russian, and I just loved to be a hostess. And they kept encouraging Dick and me to come to Yakutsk. No, we said, we spent 2 months there. We're not going to go on a one-week programmed visit. But I was invited because of my work at the borough to an economic conference called the Bridging Conference, Bridging Conference, in the fall of 1992. Well, I couldn't go. I had a job. Oh, no. my position was cut out of the budget at the borough, and I was suddenly without a job. Well, of course, I would love to come to Yakutsk. And so I went over several weeks in advance so that I could study the community a little bit. I did do some work with their economic ministry. I'm not sure what it was called at that time. But I was then able to get background information about Yakutsk. So I wasn't just talking about how we could have business relationships, but had some idea of the community. But my secret goal in going to Yakutsk was two things. First of all, when Dick and I had crossed on the Trans-Siberian Railroad in Irkutsk, near Lake Baikal, we had a guide who was from the north. His name was Vladimir Smirnov. And he taught English somewhere in the north. I asked Kappa, who was in charge of our sister city contacts, is there any way that I could possibly make contact with him? Oh, she happened to know him. Oh. So she said, you write an advertisement in the paper that you're seeking to make contact. And I did that. And in August 1992, Vladimir Smirnov came to Yakutsk, because he knew Kappa. And there, after 24 years, to me at the time, it was symbolic of what we were so hoping this new relationship with Russia was going to be. Well, what it was going to become. And I said in an interview, oh, someday this is not going to even be interesting because there'll be so many exchanges. Unfortunately, these 24 or 25 years later, no, it's the opposite. We've gone back to the Cold War. But I made contact with Vladimir, and he sat in the kitchen reading Dick's journal where Dick had said he could become a dangerous man. And he wrote a letter back to Dick, and he said, but I didn't. I lost my job because I was too close with these two visitors from Alaska. He had difficulties with the government. We, too, had difficulties with the American government because why did we want to spend 2 months in the Soviet Union? I'm still asked, and it was simply because we were interested in people and the friendships that were made. And Dick was able to go and visit Vladimir in his town of Mirny in Yakutia. And my other goal was I wanted to teach at Yakutsk State University. And Kappa set it up that I went and I interviewed with them. I said, you don't have to pay me, but you have to provide me a place to live. And I will be coming under an appointment from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. University of Alaska Fairbanks made that appointment with a stipulation. They were not paying me 1 cent. And as a result, actually the university in Yakutsk did pay me an honorarium. And they provided Dick and me a place to live. That was the beginning of many years there. Throughout the 90s, then, Dick and I went to Russia, to Yakutia, and taught. When I said early in this interview, the fact that we went in 1968 across the Soviet Union, it was the beginning of my whole career. I was always teaching, and in the 90s, I taught at Yakutsk State University. But later, I began to teach whatever, wherever, because under Rotary grants, because I started establishing Rotary clubs in the Russian Far East. Those clubs were very dear to me, although Rotary International is no longer affiliated, And that's related to our present toxic relationship between our governments. I taught in Yakutia and also in Petropavlovsk-Kamchatsky and had so many interesting experiences that I've actually written a book. And the book is being held at this time by the University of Alaska Fairbanks Press, University of Alaska Press. We haven't come up with the money yet to get it published, but anyhow, it was such an exciting time to be in Russia and to live with the ordinary people and to realize what their lives were like. This is not Moscow. This is not St. Petersburg. This is Siberia, and this is in the northern part of Siberia, and their lives were very difficult. That's what I wanted people to understand from the book. And you see, Dick always wrote journals. And in the years that he then became handicapped, I sat and we talked about this book. And this book developed because it was something for him to think about to keep his mind going in a time when he lost his hearing. He became totally deaf in 1999. Oh, what a great excuse that I couldn't go back and teach. You see, between 1993, when I first went to the university, and 1999, the students changed. At first, they were idealistic, and they bought my idealism. And by 1999, they just wanted to know how to make money. That's not my goal in life. It's the people aspect. But I couldn't go back because Dick couldn't go travel. He was totally deaf, which meant he had no balance. So from 1999 until he passed away in 2017, I was his full-time caregiver. At first, his mind was very sharp, and we even traveled to Europe, Dick's background being Finnish, and mine, of course, the German. We went and visited family, and it was not so difficult because Dick's mind was intact. Eventually, he had to go into the nursing home because of lack of balance. I had to be with him 24/7 to keep him from falling. And that became a great burden. And in 2011, he thought he would forget that he had no balance, and he got up out of his chair, and when he went to fall, he pulled a bookcase over on himself and broke several ribs. And at that time then, I could no longer administer all the medications he needed for the pain, and he went into the Pioneer Home. And that is when we worked on this book that eventually became my memoir. But it was a situation where Dick was so generous in supporting me. Well, yes, I had to go back to Yakutsk. So I did go back and visit the people that I had worked with through Rotary and also through the university in Yakutsk. These are very special connections, and the book became my memoir. I had health problems as well, and we worked them through. I'm very thankful for how my life unfolded, because it wasn't anything that I ever had designed. I just wanted to be a teacher. And I did have the privilege of not only being a German teacher, but then using the economic training in the borough in another position. And by the way, that office still exists. But instead of being five people, as when I was manager, it's all on the computer. Oh, I'm so glad I'm not there, because I am not a computer person, and it's one person today.
Okay. Can you tell us about how you came to be at Raven's Landing?
I had promised Dick As long as he could go home, I would never sell the house. And so in the early years that he was at the Pioneer Home, I would go for lunch with him, and every afternoon I took him out, either for a drive or just to go back to the house. We lived within a mile, and he could sit in his favorite chair or sleep in his own bed if he wanted to take a nap. But in 2013, I had three major decisions that I had to make. I didn't know when I started the year. I thought I was going to lead a group to Yakutsk, but they all failed to materialize. And first, I had to buy a new car because my old car got hit twice in the same place. And they decided it's got to be replaced. Make such a decision by myself. I called my daughter and said, will you help me? Well, now, Mom, you know I have four children. I cannot just drop everything and come help you. But you do this. You treat yourself to a nice lunch, and you shop around, and don't buy anything, just to see what's available. And I found exactly what I wanted, and I bought a car all by myself. And that was in January, late January. And when I showed Dick, he said, well, why did you replace the old car? He didn't understand. In March, I came to Raven Landing for an exercise class, and they were just opening up Building 3. I mentioned to somebody in the class, what do I have to do to get into Raven Landing? It always had appealed to me as a good location. Oh, she took me to the manager, and the manager showed me this apartment, and there were several others, but I knew when I saw this apartment, this was going to be home. And I measured everything so that the day I moved in and called it home, the 1st of April, everything was brought in and put exactly where it still is because I hate to move. What appealed to me about Raven Landing was I really didn't want to live in that big house by myself. And in July, Dick could no longer go home. They called me from the Pioneer Home. We had two incidents where I had taken him home and he had said, I'm not going back to the home. This is my house. I know I can stay here. And I said, I'll call 911 for help. And he said, do it. You see, he had dementia, but he was always in control. And so I did call the police. They were very supportive. Everything in communication had to always be in writing with Dick. And that's what complicated the whole situation. The policeman always backed me up by writing, yes, do what Leslie says. And at that time, then he could no longer go home. And I thought, oh, I don't want to have this house empty through a winter. I don't want to have the expense. So I told and I had a wonderful realtor. The realtor knew how to manage me because I set the price here, and he said, I wanted wiggle room. He said, set it at the lowest price that you'll take. You want to get rid of this before winter. So I did. And he worked with my daughter who lives in Anchorage, who is very good with this sort of thing. And made a list of what had to be done to sell the house. And Hilka made a list for my two son-in-laws. They were to do this, and he was to do that, and so forth. Katie took care of the six grandchildren and saw to it that we had meals in the evening. And in 6 days, the house was ready to sell. And a week later, it was sold. 2013 was a momentous year. I bought a car, that's kind of a little baby step, and then I moved in and I took exactly from the house what I wanted and told the girls in July, whatever is there, it's yours to get rid of. You can either keep it, sell it, take it to the dumps, but I could let go of it That was such a gift because I had no stress. Selling the house was a piece of cake, and two people bid against each other up to the price that I originally wanted because I had that realtor who managed me so very well. I've always respected him for that. And furthermore, they paid cash, and I didn't have to do any more work. It was all done. It was all done, and Dick was still clear of mind enough. He could direct how that money was to be invested, and he was in control. Katie brought him home the last day that we were at the house and walked him through and showed him, "You see, Dad, your bed's not there. Oh, your chair is no longer there. We are selling the house." We did not do it behind his back. And then he stood at the back door and he looked out and he saw the playhouse was gone. "Oh," he said, and tears rolled down his face, "I could have repaired it again." No. It was so, the wood was so rotten and so bad that it had to be torn down. It was a safety issue. But Dick never asked to go to the house again because Katie had managed Dick in a loving way to make it clear, we are doing this. So that's how I came to be here at Raven Landing.
And since you've been here, how's your experience been?
I'm very happy at Raven Landing. It was an adjustment for me to learn. I live in a common housing. I had to change some things. But Susan said, "You can have a garden." And my garden was what was hard for me to sell. And I have a postage stamp just outside my door. And I could bring my cat. Those were the two very important things to me. There are adjustments to living in a common house. I had never, ever locked my door on Coppett Street. And now I had to lock my door at night until I realized, yes, because if someone comes into my apartment, they have access to everyone else. I had to think about other people. So living at Raven Landing has been a good experience, a maturing experience for me. And I've learned there are some things that I don't have to do just because I live here. And one of them is I go over and pick up my dinner and bring it back and always sat here with the cat on my lap when I was eating. So some people have been very critical that I don't eat in the dining room. It's a matter of I maintain my own independence. And best of all, I have been able to continue traveling. I have my garden, I have my cat, I have my travels.
The perfect ending to a really great story.
Yep.
Thank you so much, Leslie. That was really, really fun.
Well, and as I told you,